Today, on this episode of the PeerDirect Special Spotlight.
I think it's worth stepping back and asking, is the atopic march still the right way to think about disease progression? Or do we need to rethink it entirely?
Today, Drs. Gupta and Newhall joined the podcast to discuss revisiting atopic march in the era of type 2 inflammation in this PeerDirect Specialist Spotlight. All opinions expressed are those of the presenters and do not necessarily reflect the views of this educational initiative's supporters.
Hello, I'm Dr. Ruchi Gupta, professor of pediatrics and medicine at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago.
And I'm Dr. Kelly Newhall, an allergist and immunologist from Chicago Family Asthma and Allergy.
Kelly, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure, Ruchi.
Kelly, I'd like to spend some time discussing an interesting topic that we as physicians often see play out in our clinical practices. That is a sort of rethinking of atopic march through the lens of type 2 inflammation. Over the years, we've all been taught that the atopic march, as this fairly linear progression, beginning with eczema in infancy to food allergy, and then asthma and allergic rhinitis. It's been a useful framework, especially when we're counseling families. And as you know, because you've known my daughter since the very beginning, she went through this so-called march. You know, started out with very severe eczema, right, but very soon after developed food allergies. So now, with everything we understand about type 2 inflammation, the shared cytokine pathways, barrier dysfunction, and the fact that many patients don't follow that classic sequence, I think it's worth stepping back and asking, is the atopic march still the right way to think about disease progression? Or do we need to rethink it entirely? Now, that classic atopic march that we think about, which is exactly what happened to my personal life with my daughter, is the atopic dermatitis, then time passes to food allergy, and then asthma, and then allergic rhinitis. Atopic march was never really a biologic pathway, was it? It was more of a clinical observation.
Correct. It was based on epidemiology. It wasn't based on a mechanism or the pathophysiology that's underlying these problems. It's a helpful framework, especially to teach families, but it was probably oversimplified.
So what's changed? What do we know now?
I think that, you know, over time and seeing these patients with multiple allergic diseases, we've realized that there is no one progression. It's not a sequential progression. And they often present with multiple problems at the same time. It's really that they share an underlying biology, like abnormalities in cytokines, IL-4, 13, 5, TSLP. Those are some of the many cytokines that underlie allergic diseases. So often these diseases are, they're parallel expressions. They're not sequential steps. And you don't necessarily march through all those progressions. You also may not have all of these diseases. You may have some of them and not all of them. Yes. And one of them may be the most problematic in that patient's life.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I see that very clearly, professionally and personally. And barrier dysfunction is usually the starting point. And I see this in my patients, and I see this with my own daughter. It may not be a march, but it manifests as a shared vulnerability that manifests differently across organs. So, of course, skin barrier dysfunction, filaggrin, et cetera, leads to allergen sensitization.
And also like an underlying airway epithelium, like the disruption of that, you know, predisposing them to illness and to more allergen exposure, disruption of the skin of the GI tract and the development of EOE, eosinophilic esophagitis or food allergies. Yeah. And also environmental exposures, you know, what are they exposed to in their environment that's going to increase their TH2 potential?
And there's clinical implications for this. So should we intervene earlier? Are we actually preventing disease or are we just delaying it? And early aggressive atopic derm treatment, does it prevent progression? Data is mixed, but it's evolving and we need more. Right. Early allergen introduction, peanut and other common allergens.
I think we're asking the question also, is using some of our newer biologic medications, is that going to modify the disease progression? Are these disease modifiers? Dupilumab is one of the kind of, it's one of our biologics that we're able to use in 6 months and older for atopic dermatitis. And we're now seeing the question, is that a potential disruptor of this TH2 potential of these little patients?
Yeah.
So.
And is atopic March still useful as a clinical framework? You know, atopic March isn't dead, but it's no longer the map. It's useful as a risk framework, but not as a deterministic pathway.
It's helpful for teaching our patients. And it's also, my patients often make fun of me because I ask every time for all of these different TH2 diseases, even if they're seeing me for food allergies, I ask them about symptoms consistent with asthma or for allergic rhinitis or EoE. I ask them about all these things in growth, just anticipating that they might have a possible comorbidity in addition to what they originally came to see me for.
So what are the clinical implications? Should we intervene earlier? You know, are we actually preventing disease or just delaying it? So there's like two main things I think we often think about, and that is aggressive early atopic derm treatment. And will this prevent the progression? Now, you know, in Rhea's case, at that time, like 19 years ago, all we had or all I was given and thought about even personally is steroids, right? And it was just lathering her with steroids and then repeated flares and then lather with steroids. But now we have quite a few treatments.
We have a lot of options now. We have a lot of non-steroidal options. We even have prescription moisturizers that have prescription ceramides to help to, you know, to help to protect that barrier. The question is for infants, if we have them, if we protect them by giving them a better barrier, are we going to prevent progression of allergic diseases? Are we going to prevent their, you know, increased risk of having other problems? Right. And it's a relief to parents to have options like PDE4 inhibitors are it's a non-steroid intervention that you can use in infants. I think the one of them is 12 months and up, which is a good option other than our kind of standard fallback, which has been topical steroids. Yes. And sadly, a lot of times we've had to do oral steroids, like, you know, for children with very severe atopic dermatitis, you know, that obviously has risk factors that we'd like to avoid. You know, Ruchi, I agree with your point that if we can use more aggressive emollient therapy, can we help to protect this barrier and prevent kind of early acquisition of allergies?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one thing in, I guess, our culture is we don't recommend early to protect that skin barrier. And we know how important that skin barrier is now. And in a lot of other places around the world, you know, regular oil or some type of moisturizing
right.
is a part of their daily routine for their infants. So if we were to begin that early, and there are a lot of studies ongoing really looking at this, so we will hopefully have more answers soon. But what we do know is that skin barrier is, you know, first line. That's your protective layer, you know, biggest organ system of your body. So Protecting that is essential. But in addition to the non-steroidals, we have dupilumab now.
We do. And dupilumab is indicated down to 6 months and above for moderate to severe atopic dermatitis. And now we're asking the question, because it acts on so many, it really affects the TH2 immune system, is it a potential disruptor? Could this potentially change that patient's risk of having other allergic diseases if we treat earlier?
Yes, and that's really exciting. And I know there's a lot of work going on around that because around 6 months when dupilumab is, you know, allowed
for use,
or approved, yeah. Around 6 months when dupilumab is approved for use is usually the same time where they're starting solids. And when we talk now about starting solids, I think this is an important topic because our whole way of thinking about it has changed. When in the past, when we saw this increased rise of food allergies, we said, you know, don't introduce certain foods early, like peanut products, not till age 3, or egg till age 2. But then after, you know, the LEAP study, which showed that in severe eczema patients or infants with egg allergy, it significantly reduced their incidence of peanut allergy. So it's been interesting because you've seen in the U.S. this complete reversal, and now—
Well, in our career, it's gone 180.
Yes.
Like, I mean, when we started, it was like, you know, don't give peanut till age three, you know, and don't give, you know—
I mean, and the New York Times, when the LEAP study came out, after saying my quote, said Dr. Gupta slapping herself on the wrist for not introducing peanut products to her own daughter earlier. So we're all guilted for whatever we do or we don't do.
There's a lot of guilt in parenting.
Yes.
So, you know, there's...
Definitely. But what the recommendations show now, and this is something where I know we've talked about this, but, you know, we're really medicalizing infant feeding, and that needs to go away. So currently, you know, the recommendations are start a new food every 3 to 5 days and wait until they tolerate it for 3 to 5 days to start another food. And that's just not the way it's done.
Well, I think it's more like we just need to make sure that kids are getting fed.
Yes.
And that they're getting exposed to these allergens on a very basic level. And I know it sounds very flip when I say that, but especially when foods are a part of a family's culture and a part of their diet, getting those foods in their diet at an early age is very, very important.
Yes.
So like having, for example, for, you know, patients who have a lot of sesame in their diet, making sure they get sesame seed at an early age, especially if they look like an allergic baby. If they have that moderate eczema, getting that food in their diet is essential.
Yes.
Essential.
And what you said is so key. So the foods that the families are eating in their household. So get those foods into your baby early, because one of the theories is exposure to that food protein through your skin before your gut is what may...
Right.
stimulate this whole TH2 pathway. So there's a through your skin, allergies begin through your diet, they stay quiet. So really focusing on the foods that are in your household. So if you have, you know, cashew is a big part of your diet, then make sure you get that into your infant.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So is atopic March still useful as a clinical framework?
I think it's useful as a risk framework, and it's a good way to teach, you know, families to say, hey, your family, your baby is at risk, but it's not predetermined. Like, just because you have eczema does not mean you're going to have, you know, 100% have food allergy or asthma, but it's something that we need to be aware of and look for just so we can intervene as early as possible.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Kelly. So maybe the takeaway is that atopic March still helps us think about risk. But in practice, we need to look at these as interconnected type 2 diseases that don't always follow a predictable path.
Exactly. And as we better understand the importance of barrier dysfunction in the shared TH2 pathways, the opportunity is that we can intervene earlier and identify high-risk patients and potentially change their trajectory rather than just managing it. We can actually make a difference in kind of their future. Thank you so much, Ruchi.
And thank you for watching. We hope this discussion will help as you approach patients with allergic diseases in your practice.
And that's today's Specialist Spotlight. Thank you for joining us for this episode of PeerDirect Medical News Podcast. For more stories like these, visit us at peerdirect.com. Thoughts, comments, or suggestions? Please leave us a review in your preferred listening platform or email us at editorial@peerdirect.com. Listen and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also download our Amazon Alexa Flash Briefing Medical News Roundup and just ask, what's my flash briefing? Thanks today to our guests, Drs. Gupta and Newhall. Join me next time for an episode where we cover the latest stories in the world of medicine.